I often get drawn into thinking life's all about me. Selfishness reigns often in my heart. It's expressed in how I even think about my Christian life. My relationship with God is all about me. God's there to serve me, to look after me, to give me eternal life, to save me. Then that's expressed at times in how I view church. So I come to be served. I want an entertaining sermon, a challenging sermon, an intellectual sermon. I want something to pep me up, make me feel good, align me for the week. I want to sing songs that make me feel joyful. I want to catch up with my friends, have a little chat, and then go home. Now, none of us would ever articulate it so bluntly. But if you're anything like me, there are bits of that within your heart as you gather here on a Sunday. And yet God's purposes for saving us and for us as a church are far greater than just me or you. See, Exodus 19 reshifts our thinking on this. Exodus 19 is the start of a section that runs right through to Exodus 24. And it outlines God's covenant with his people. Covenant simply is a promise agreement between two parties. And here on one side is the Lord, and we see what he has done. And the other reveals, as it were, what he expects of his people. Simply put, this covenant, this agreement says, I am your God, this is what that entails, and you are my people, and this is how you're to live. Reflect me. And what we see in Exodus 19 are God's purposes for his people that are far greater than we ever imagine, because we forget how majestic his purposes for us are, and we forget how overwhelmingly gracious he is to us. And Exodus 19, verses 1 to 8, just begin to reorientate us back to him and his purposes. So firstly then, God graciously rescues his people as he promised. God graciously rescues his people as he promised, verses 1 to 4. Have a look. When buying your house or choosing your holiday, location, location, location is everything, isn't it? And it is here. See, why does Moses spend two verses telling us where they are? Verse 1, 3 months now, they're out of Egypt. And they come to the desert of Sinai. Then verse 2, after they set out from Rephidim, they've entered the desert of Sinai, and Israel camped there in the desert in front of the mountain. I mean, it's very specific. They're there at Sinai, in front of the mountain. Why is that so significant? Because Exodus 3, verse 12. Remember what God had said to Moses from the burning bush? God has said to Moses, I will be with you, and this will be the sign to you that it is I who have sent you. When you have brought the people out of Egypt, you will worship God on this mountain. See, how will Moses know that the God of his fathers, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, the God of Jacob had gone with him and had rescued the Israelites? God would bring him to this very mountain where he first met Moses, and the people will worship God there. And the location underlines God has faithfully kept his promise. Faithfully kept his promise to Moses and to the people. God heard their cry. He remembered his promises with Abraham back in Genesis 15. Do you remember? Where God has said to Abraham, look, you'll have descendants, but they will be enslaved and mistreated. But I'll punish the nation they serve as slaves. Afterwards, they'll come out with great possessions. And here they are out of that slave, enslaved nation, and they're camping on the very mountain God had said they would, just as he promised. God is utterly faithful to his word and to his promises. It's like Moses is underlining, you can trust what God says, do you? And then look what happens, verse 3, Moses went up to the Lord. Throughout this section, the language of up, down will keep appearing. Moses will go up to the Lord. He'll come back down to the people, speaking to them what the Lord had told him. each little kind of up, down will mark a new section. But more significantly, here is God relating with his people. He's not some distant deity, but an imminent one. One who is with. One who will ultimately dwell amongst his people. Just get a little snapshot here of how God relates to his people. He's a speaking God. He reveals his purposes. And so God calls, verse 3, to Moses from the mountain, just as he had in Exodus 3. And he tells Moses to say this to the people. This is what you are to say to the descendants of Jacob and what you are to tell the people of Israel. Verse 4. You yourselves have seen what I did to Egypt and how I carried you on eagle's wings and brought you to myself. God reminds the people that he rescued them. They had seen what he did to Egypt, how he had carried them and brought them to himself. And he caused them to recall how he destroyed Egypt, how he judged them, how he brought plague upon plague against the Egyptians, how he led the Egyptian army into the Red Sea and then brought the waters crashing down on them, wiping out the entire army and all that threatened his people. And as God does that to Egypt, where are God's people? Safe. Safe on the eagle's wings. I mean, it's a beautiful picture, isn't it? Of God as this powerful, majestic, splendid bird with its huge wingspan, tenderly carrying his people on his wings, swooping them away from the danger, protecting them from the Egyptians and from his own judgments. And of course, the metaphor of the eagles summarizes all he did in saving them. The distinctions in the plagues, how he provided the lambs that the angel of death passed over, the leading of the people by cloud by day and fire at night, the confusing of the Egyptians, the parting of the Red Sea, that his people might safely walk through on dry ground. The provision of manna in the desert, the waters from the rock, the defeat of the Amalekites. He alone rescued them, keeping his promises as they sat safely on his wings. They did nothing. They watched God act. He alone brought them to himself, to Sinai, to this mountain as he promised. And he doesn't just, as it were, set them free from Egypt. Hey, go and do what you want. No, he brings them to himself. He saves them for relationship with himself. Relationship with God always, always begins with him rescuing his people. Every other religion speaks of how we get to God, how we bring ourselves to him through doing and through acts of obedience, through good works. And if we've done enough, we're safe. But the God of the Bible says he brought us to himself. And just as he carried his people, the Egyptians, on eagle's wings, so he brings us to himself. And he carries us on eagle's wings, where the eagle, as it were, is Jesus. And Jesus alone on a cross outside of Jerusalem bears God's judgment, God's punishment for our sin and our rebellion against God. And as Jesus bears that judgment, he defeats our greatest enemies, not a mighty nation, but he defeats sin and death and Satan. And where are we as Jesus does this? Safe. Safe on his wings. Like the Israelites, we're watching him act and looking to him as he brings us to himself. Not now to Mount Sinai, but to the heavenly mountain and to relationship with him for all eternity. And there is nothing we can do. Isn't that a beautiful picture in and of itself? There is nothing you can do to save yourself or bring yourself to God. We look to Jesus to carry us on his wings. As he carries us safely through judgment, and he carries us safely through death, and he carries us safely through all the hardships and the trials and the difficulties of life, to where he'll bring us to him, where we'll meet him on that heavenly mountain. Isn't that a wonderful picture? And God, having reminded the people of his faithfulness to them, his kind of overwhelming grace to them in rescuing them, in keeping his promises to have a people, doesn't just bring them to him and leave it there. He doesn't just say, hey, you've met me, now go. He now spells out what it means to live as his people. See, secondly, God rescues his people, calling them to live obediently as his treasured possession to bless the world. God rescues his people, calling them to live obediently as his treasured possession to bless the world. See, what will it mean to live in a covenant relationship with God, for him to be their God and for them to be his people? Verse 5, have a look. God says, now if you obey me fully and keep my covenant, then out of all the nations, you will be my treasured possession. Now, sometimes we read that and we think, okay, they must now obey to become God's people. No. Verse 4 has already shown the motivation for this covenant relationship. It's grace. God has chosen to display his gracious favor upon them by rescuing them and redeeming them and bringing them to himself. They are his people. Now flowing from his grace to them comes what he has called them to be, obedient. Now a lot of misunderstanding arises on this, because often when we speak of the Old Testament covenant, we speak of it as law. And then what happens in the New Testament and the New Covenant under Jesus, we talk of as grace. As if the distinction between the two covenants is law versus grace. But right here at the offset, it's clear. The Old Covenant, God's relationship with his people in the Old Testament, is based upon grace. And grace, God's kindness, motivates the keeping of the covenant, just as we find in the new covenant. See, the basis for their relationship here, from the point of view of Israel, is that they were to have confidence in and trust in, as well as gratitude to God, because of all the events of the Exodus, because he carried them on his wings to save them, because he poured out his love and grace on them. And as such, they're now to live as his people, in obedience to him, that they might be like him, holy. And the same is true for us. That's why Jesus says, John 15, if you love me, then you'll obey my commands. And you love him because of the cross, because he first loved us. Flowing from his grace to us at the cross, where we place our trust and confidence in him and his ways and demonstrate our gratitude and love for him in obedience as I seek to be like him. See, when I've grasped God's grace to me in rescuing me, then my response is always obedience, motivated by love, to be like him, to be his. What is unlike the new here is that the covenant keeping in the old depends on Israel's promise to obey, verse 8. When Moses comes down and says it all to them, they all responded together, we'll do everything the Lord has said. Ours, though, is fulfilled for us by Jesus. And of course, what we'll see with the Old Testament people is that they can't keep it. Their sin, in the end, breaks the relationship, destroys the relationship. What they need is one who can keep it perfectly, that the relationship can be ongoing. But it's based on grace. They're his because of him. And so when we read verse 5, now if you obey me fully and keep my covenant, then out of all the nations you will be my treasured possession. And we read it with verse 4 firmly in mind, the if-then clause is not saying, if you obey me, then you will be rewarded as my treasured possession. They are his people. No, the clause works in the sense of, for example, if you accept my offer to teach you, and you devote yourselves to learning to play the drums, then you will have the satisfaction of being a drummer. The then clause, as it were, spells out what is inherent in the if. In other words, if they live as God's people, as they've brought to him, then they will have the delight of being his treasured possession. This is based on grace. And what does being God's treasured possession entail? Well, it's worth seeing that the images in verse 5 and 6 connect. So the idea of treasured possession is parallel with the pictures of kingdom of priests and the holy nation in verse 6. They're in effect like the left and right speakers of a stereo system. Each side differs slightly to produce the surround sound effect to give the dimension. Both statements here are in effect saying the same thing, but each does it in a different way. They're looking at it from a different perspective, so that in the end we'll see that to be his treasured possession is to be a king of a priest and a holy nation. To be a king of a priest and a holy nation is to be his treasured possession. And that first statement, to be his treasured possession, just think about that for a moment. Saying it's to be God's private treasure. The word possession is the same word used in 1 Chronicles 29 verse 3 for King David's own private stash, his vault of gold and silver, David's personal store of all things precious and valuable. So although David, king, ruled over all, he has this vast, as it were, kingdom wealth, he also has his own private wealth, that which was special to him. When my sister was younger, she had a very special doll that went everywhere with her. Cherry doll. And it even came on holiday. And for some bizarre reason, the pressure in the aeroplane cabin caused the head to collapse, which brought much despair to a 2-3-year-old, but much amusement to an 11 and 9-year-old boys. But Cherry doll was special, treasured, went everywhere. Picture here. All the nations are God's. They belong to him. Ruled by him ultimately. There is nothing that is not his. But he's saying, you Israel, you will be my treasured possession, my private treasure. Put it another way, it's as if like God has a majestic ring on his finger and the nations are represented by the gold setting. But Israel's the jewel in the middle. That's how he feels about them. When he says, look at my ring, people don't look at the gold setting, they look at the jewel. He's saying, look at my people. They're my treasured possession. Imagine how that transformed how they viewed themselves. They went from being slaves of a wicked king to being the treasure of a heavenly king. And just as he's devoted to them, so they're to be devoted to him as his treasure. And you can begin to see how the parallel with verse 6, although the whole earth is mine, you will be for me a kingdom of priests, a holy nation. Israel were to be a kingdom in which, as a whole, they had a priestly function. Now, what does a priest do? Well, chapter 19, verse 22 of Exodus, we see the priests are able to approach God. They have access to him. They are consecrated, devoted to him, him alone. No other gods. So Israel as a priestly kingdom was to worship no one else. They were to worship God alone. They were his treasured possession. He was their God alone. And as priests, as seen later in the temple, priests had two really specific functions. The first one was the priests represented the Lord to the people. The priests represented the Lord to the people. And so as it kind of works itself out in the temple and the tabernacle as we go through the story, we discover that Aaron, the first high priest, his garment, the clothing that he wore, was made of the same material as the curtain of the most holy place. The curtain of the most holy place was the big thick curtain that kind of separated out the rest of the temple from the most holy place. The most holy place was where God's presence dwelt. Curtain separated that. The high priest, allowed to enter into that most holy place once a year to offer sacrifices on behalf of the people. And the word glory is only used in Exodus of the Lord, with the significant exception of Aaron's garments. In the sense, Aaron, as he entered the most holy place with these garments that were of similar material, bore God's glory to the people. See, the people could not enter access to the most holy place to witness God's glory, but they could see Aaron and his garments as he came out, and so in that sense they could witness God's glory there. The priest, as it were, represented the Lord to the people. They captured and saw his glory as he stood before them. Couldn't see God himself, but they could see Aaron and his glorious garments. But the priests also represented Israel to the Lord. So on top of his glorious garments, Aaron wore this ephod, which he wore on his chest, and it carried 12 stones representing the tribes of Israel. So when Aaron stood before God, Israel stood before God. When Aaron presented the blood of the sacrifice, which secured forgiveness, Israel presented it and benefited from it. He were, as it were, presented Israel to the Lord himself. See, in other words, the presence and the activity of priests therefore creates the possibility of relationship between God and his people. Now, if that was what was happening in the, as it were, the micro for Israel with their priests and them, now they're called a priestly kingdom. As a priestly kingdom, it created the possibility of relationship for others to be able to see God and be represented before God. Because as a priestly kingdom, Israel was to represent God to the world and the world to God. The world could not see God, didn't have access, but the world could see Israel. And should have seen God's glory revealed in them, just as Israel, as it were, saw his glory in Aaron's garments. And as Israel lived as though devoted to Yahweh alone in worship, with him dwelling in their midst and their worship of him touching every area of their lives, from the sacrifices that demonstrated how one gained access to a holy, perfect God, to what they ate and wore, revealing their distinctiveness to him alone, to their justice that reflected his, to their good stewardship of the earth as that which he had made, to their care of foreigners, revealing his concern for the outsiders. See, they were to reflect his glory to the world. They were on mission, as it were. They weren't being sent out, but they were drawing the nations in as they displayed the goodness of God, the goodness of his rule, and the goodness of what it was to be his people as they lived as his devoted priests, displaying his glory to the world. But they were also to represent the world to God by praying for and interceding for the nations. They were a priestly kingdom. They were to pray on behalf of the nations. And they were to be a holy nation. They were to be holy as God is holy. That word holy is often used of the tabernacle and the priestly function. That which was consecrated, devoted to God, distinctive as holy. They were to reflect the very holiness of the God they served. Which is why when God often gives his law, he often begins it with, "Be holy as I'm holy." See, the laws and the Ten Commandments are not about how to become his people, but about being his distinctive holy people, a holy nation reflecting him, so that to a watching world, they would see God's treasured possession, his priestly kingdom, his holy nation, and want to be part of it. Because Israel was to bless the world. See, when God gave his promises to Abraham in Genesis 12, God promised Abraham many descendants, and through those descendants, all people, all nations of the earth will be blessed through you. And his Israel's calling was ultimately to bless the world as they represented God to the world and the world to God as his kingdom of priests and the holy nation as his treasured possession. The world was meant to see. and of course as God's people now, under the new covenant, we're still called to live obediently as his treasured possession to bless the world. That's why Peter in 1 Peter chapter 2 speaks of the church, God's people saved by Jesus, those brought to him on the wings of Christ. Peter then describes in the very same terms the church in the terms of Exodus 19. So 1 Peter 2 verse 9, we read, "You're a chosen people, a royal priesthood, a holy nation, God's special possession." See, that the church, God's people, us, those trusting in Christ, have now become the jewel in the ring. We become his personal treasure, that special possession. Out of all peoples, we're his. Jesus' treasured possession. Which, of course, transforms not just how we view ourselves personally, but also corporately. That as we gather, we're not just a group of nobodies with all our troubles and brokenness and mess, and it's part. You know, somehow just gathering to meet our needs, catch up with our mates, hear a good sermon, we hope. We're his treasured possession. So what we do matters. Because we're to represent God to the world. And we're a royal priesthood. As those who are priests of King Jesus. And what's our task? To represent God to the world in mission, represent the world to God in prayer. The world cannot see Jesus, but the world can see the church, his body, and should be able to see his glory there in us. Now, under the Old Testament, the nations were to come to Israel, but under the New, Jesus sends his people out to make disciples. That's why we're not all gathered with all believers in one land, but we're as those sent out to the world. We're on mission. We're to represent God to the world as his kingly priests. So the world watches us to see what it means to be devoted to Jesus, as those devoted to him alone in worship. Worship that touches every aspect of our lives. That's why Paul writes, Romans 12, verses 1 to 2, "Therefore, in view of God's mercy, in view of the cross, offer your bodies as living sacrifices, holy and pleasing to God. This is your true and proper worship." How's that then seen? It's seen in our lives, and seen how we do family. It's seen how we are in our workplaces, how we are with our neighbours, how we speak to our kids, how we speak to one another, how we do church on a Sunday. It's all part of our worship as those devoted to Jesus. That's why Peter goes on, he writes 2 verse 12, "Live such good lives among the pagans that they may see your good deeds and glorify God on the day he visits us." We represent God to the world. So do those around you know you're devoted to Jesus, his treasured possession, part of his royal priesthood. Because they've seen how you're worshiping him in the truest sense in every area of your life, wherever the Lord has placed you. So tomorrow morning, wherever you are, whether it's sitting at a desk or being with the kids or catching up with the friends or doing some other job, are you thinking, "I'm on mission. I'm a treasured possession. I'm a royal priesthood. I'm seeking to represent the Lord to the world"? That's your purpose. And then as we gather Sunday by Sunday, seeking to declare his praises together, our purpose is also to represent him to a watching world, that they might see our corporate devotion to Jesus. And part of what we do, isn't it? We don't just represent, as it were, God to the world, but we're also representing the world to God, praying for the nations, for the lost. That's why we pray Sunday by Sunday for different nations, because we have a responsibility as a royal priesthood to represent the world to God. We don't just do that corporately, we do that individually. So how often do you pray each week for the nations and for the lost? You're a royal priesthood. It's part of your calling as his priests. like Israel, were called to be a holy nation, a holy people. It's again why Peter uses the language of Leviticus in 1 Peter 1 verse 15. He writes, "But just as he who called you is holy, so be holy in all you do, for it is written, be holy because I am holy." As we live as a holy people, reflecting our God. That's why Jesus says, if you love me, you'll obey my commands. Because just as he, in his love for his Father, only did what his Father said, reflecting his Father perfectly. So as we seek to obey Jesus' words and his commands, we're seeking to be like him, holy, a holy people, that those around us may see how we live and glorify God. We're called to live distinctive lives that we might represent God to a watching world in order to bless the world. See, that promise of Genesis 12 of nations being blessed through Abraham's descendants is ultimately fulfilled in the descendant Jesus, isn't he? He's the one who ultimately blesses the world through his death and resurrection, bringing us to God. But as those who are his priests, his body, his treasured possession, our task is to make him known, to bless the world with the good news through living devoted lives of worship to Jesus in all that we do, that they might see Jesus in us, that they might know his blessing. So why did God rescue us? Why did he rescue Israel? So that through his rescue, the nations might know that he is the Lord. See, which means my selfish thinking about my salvation and about church can't be right. Of course, it's a great joy to celebrate being saved. We want to rejoice in that. And of course, the Lord meets me and sustains me and strengthens me and gives me grace. But you see, his purposes are far greater. His greater purpose is that the world would know his blessing, that the world would know Jesus, that we would represent him to the world, and we would represent the world to him. Has that been seen in your life this week, tomorrow morning, Thursday afternoon, Saturday lunchtime? What will it look like?